Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. We're just going to get started. This is the session for human health and welfare among our most vulnerable during disasters and emergencies. This session examines the needs of vulnerable populations when they are most at risk during emergency situations. It describes significant legal and policy concerns that arises during emergencies from mental and behavioral health providers. It also discusses the characteristics, needs, challenges, and best practices needed to involve and serve vulnerable populations before, during, and after a disaster. So at the end of this session, a few objectives. The first is participants will be able to identify systems on which vulnerable populations particularly rely and that may be threatened in severe pandemic. Describe recent evidence on the impact and effectiveness of 2009 emergency risk communications about the H1N1 influenza pandemic among African Americans, Latinos, and other communities. And lastly, you will be able to identify and evaluate best practices for convening, and conducting public engagement processes for the purpose of eliciting input from diverse communities and complex and controversial public health issues. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you again for being here. My name is Patricia Wilson. I am a recent graduate from the University from Westchester University of Pennsylvania in Pennsylvania. I have the distinct honor of introducing to you a wonderful and experienced panel of presenters for this session. And before we begin, I do have a few things I'd like to go over. The first is for the presenters. Please state whether or not you have a conflict of interest before you begin your session. Also, there is a 15 minutes maximum allotted time for your presentation, and I'll hold up notification reminders at the beginning, 15, 10, 5, 1, and end in markers. Participants, please hold your questions for the end of the presentation for each presenter. I will allot 3 minutes. And again, at the end, at the completion of all the presenters, we'll have a question and answer session. Lastly, participants and presenters, please turn off your phone or put it to silent. I am very honored to introduce to you our first presenter, James G. Hodge, Jr., JD, LLM. He is the Lincoln Professor of Health Law and Ethics at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law, Director of Public Health Law and Policy Program, Fellow Center of Law, Science, and Innovation at Arizona State University. His previous appointments include Professor at Johns Hopkins, Bloomberg School of Public Health, Adjunct Professor of Law at Georgetown University Law Center, Executive Director of the Centers for Law and Public Health. The recipient of the 2006 Henrik L. Bloom Award for Excellence in Health Policy from the American Public Health Association, he has also drafted with others several public health law reform initiatives. He is a national expert on public health information privacy law and ethics, having consulted with many different organizations, including DHHS, CDC, FDA, APHA, CMS, and OHRP. Among others. His diverse funded projects include, one, the legal framework underlining the use of volunteer health professionals during emergencies, the compilation, the study, and analysis of state genetics laws and policies as part of a multi-year NIH-funded project, and lastly, international tobacco policy for the World Health Organization Tobacco-Free Initiative. His session is on assessing the legal environment for the deployment and use of personnel to provide mental and behavioral health services during emergencies. And I would just like to add, we have an extensively experienced panel here, and I had to shorten the biographies. But believe it or not, there's a lot more I could have read. Thank you. Please welcome James Hodge.
Thank you, Patricia. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. It's great to be here today. So as you might imagine with a presentation like this and the time that we've got, I'm going to be brief. I'm going to set out the major parameters of what I'd like to discuss with you here today and look forward to questions, comments throughout the rest of our time here together. To be sure, there are no specific financial relationships or disclosures worth reporting here for our purposes. What I would like to discuss with you largely are just three main topics. I want to talk about mental and behavioral health impacts in emergencies. I want to discuss with you the legal barriers to mental health emergency preparedness and response in regards to how we respond to those specific mental health issues, and as well, the legal and policy reforms that are possible that we suggest consistent with our scholarship and what we're doing in the field to work through these specific issues. To be sure, this project is actually part of a larger effort at Johns Hopkins with colleagues of mine still back there in Baltimore, even though I'm here in Tempe, Arizona now, that is sponsored by the Centers for Disease Control. Professor John Lynx is the overall PI for the project and a great collaborator with us. This is just a collection of some of the great folks at Hopkins and elsewhere that we have to work with. I won't mention them all as you see them on the screen, but I do want to invite anyone here listening to this presentation who's intrigued by the legal and ethical issues that I'll explore with you briefly to let me know if you're interested in serving with us on our project advisory group. We've got a stellar group of 20 plus individuals nationally that we're working with in our current phase of the project and look forward to welcoming any additional folks, particularly practitioners with expertise and interests. So to be sure, the goal of this specific project is immense. It is basically to assess the legal environment and ethical environment, although I'm only here today to report largely on the legal side of what we've done, underlying the identification, the accommodation, the response, and treatment of mental illnesses and behavioral conditions before, during, and after major emergencies. That's our total focus. It's broad. We've been working with a very strong focus and really working very hard on all sorts of issues. The issues, particularly today, will focus on those public health emergency planning, mitigation, and response efforts that absolutely have to consider the mental health impacts of natural disasters, pandemics, and other emergencies as quintessential to emergency response as anything we do to rebuild the environment or to address the physical injuries that occur as a result of those conditions. Why? Because long after those emergency responders finish the job of meeting patient surge capacity on physical injuries, these mental health impacts linger. These visual images from Haiti, for example, are not things that are easily dealt with or accommodated or gotten over by populations as we speak. In fact, the impacts, even based on Hurricane Katrina data here in the United States, are severe. Look just on the far right side of this screen. This shows you the potential impacts that we may be suffering in Haiti as we speak. In Katrina, for example, it has been estimated reasonably well that 31% of the population affected in the New Orleans zone does linger with mental health injuries, and yet even just one-third of them are actually getting any specific treatment for that. Now multiply that by the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of individuals in Haiti who are simply going without long-term mental health treatment for these specific conditions. It's profound, the impact that you're seeing. There are many, many barriers to how we would address these issues, as some of you in the audience know considerably better than me. But among those barriers are legal and policy implementation issues that simply stop us or thwart us in our ability to address these mental health services deficiencies. And particularly for our project, while we could focus on the entire population and honestly would like to, we did drill down and focus mostly on who we consider the most vulnerable, those two population sets that we're most concerned about in any major emergency event. Those persons with existing mental health conditions prior to the emergency, those persons whose mental health conditions arise as a result of the emergency. There are many classes of these individuals that are particularly impactful that we're studying and working to address the legal issues in relation to. Children, without question, might be front and center for us. Elderly, without question, as regards to a vulnerable population, in this sense, very critical for us to assess. Racial and ethnic minorities have particular vulnerabilities in regards to the mental health issues because of existing stigmatization and other concerns. Issues in relation to persons in group facilities, nursing facilities, hospitals, prisons. How are these folks' issues accommodated, especially in emergencies? Something during Katrina we showed up as critically undermet. And then finally, the emergency responders themselves. These folks on the front lines put themselves in great risk of significant mental health issues. That's been well documented by others well outside of our group, but to be sure, they're a major focus for what we're trying to do. How do we accomplish and work through these specific issues? There are two major themes that we have to be able to do well, and yet legal issues may impede us. We have to be able to deploy and use the appropriate personnel in the midst of the emergencies to address the mental health issues. And yet that deployment, meeting mental health surge capacity, requires extensive personnel, considerably greater than the trained mental health practitioners like psychiatrists and psychologists who are there to provide services, some of which do that in real time in emergencies quite well. We have to look well beyond that, to counselors, to advanced practice nurses, to general practitioners, people with mental health preparedness training of any type, even clergy, counselors, people in the community. All of these people have critical roles to play, and yet all of them deal with specific legal issues that may stop them in their tracks. So, for example, issues of licensure portability, issues related to crisis standard of care, something you'll hear about more considerably from our colleague down the table, Donna Levin, issues related to their prescribing authority, what their professional liability may be in the throes of the emergency and afterwards, and issues related to when and under what circumstances they may be able to recoup for their injuries through workers' compensation. I will briefly digest each one of these thoughts and, again, look forward to a lot more discussion thereafter. Licensure portability, quite critical. What do we mean here? If you're a practitioner in Massachusetts with your psychiatrist license or license to practice psychiatry there, you cannot go to Louisiana and practice there absent some sort of special event. To be sure, that sort of portability issue is a profound one because it literally could stop the flow of practitioners working across regions. Well, to say the least, this is one of those things consistent with emergency provisions, like emergency acts that may be declared, pursuant to things like EMAC that will allow for certain reciprocity, and pursuant to an act known as the Uniform Emergency Volunteer Health Practitioners Act that explicitly recognizes these volunteers as having their licenses almost as if issued in the state in which they may be practicing. These sorts of legal techniques can be very effective for mobilizing these personnel. But there's one problem. They only apply so long as an emergency is declared. Mental health issues go well beyond when government is willing to declare formal states of emergency, months and years later. And when those emergencies are over, so goes their licensure reciprocity. Issues related to crisis standard of care, the conventional practice of how we provide mental health services, hopefully done well in non-emergencies. When we get to the crisis event, this poses critical different types of issues, something I'm going to very deferential to Donna to explain in more detail. But to be sure, we've worked with an Institute of Medicine committee, both Donna and me, on these issues, and they are very difficult to assess from a legal perspective as to what that means, how you provide that type of standard of care in a mental health environment. Issues related to prescribing authority. Many of the conditions that I'm speaking of here from a mental health perspective are considerably well treated with, obviously, prescription drugs. Controlled substances, often. And that relies upon mental health personnel who are ready, able, and capable of providing that type of service to a considerable new surge of mental health patients and persons with behavioral conditions. As you see in this brief chart here, and you can see this probably better as you'll see the slides later at home, but this just shows you the very wild divergence of the availability of mental health practitioners who are actually capable of prescribing these types of medications. They really differ extensively. You see Massachusetts with a very strong ratio of psychiatrists and child psychiatrists per 100,000 of the population. Contrast that with the lowest states like Idaho and Wyoming, where you literally do not have personnel on hand sufficient to make these drugs and to get these drugs in the hand of patients who need them most. Issues related to professional liability. There's no doubt, no matter what topic, in regards to providing health services in emergencies, liability almost dominates the issues because practitioners from a volunteer perspective meeting mental health surge capacity do not want to get tagged with liability in the course of that. And the good news is, in many ways, they won't during the course of the emergency. Because there are specific provisions like the Emergency Volunteer Acts I've talked about, like the Model Emergency Acts that you've seen proliferate among the states, and even through EMAC, that protect these people through good immunity protections, indemnification protections, if they're acting in a volunteer capacity and not engaged in gross negligence. Just like with licensure reciprocity, though, those liability exceptions disappear once the emergency is over. They literally fade away, even as mental health services are still needed for months, if not years later. Workers' compensation is profound and critical for these individuals to understand from a mental health practitioner perspective because they themselves will suffer in the throes of the emergency. They are the first responders, and they themselves will be injured mentally, sometimes to the point of requiring treatment, as they attempt to do their jobs. And even to the extent to which we can view them as doing their jobs if they're acting in a volunteer capacity, The ability of government and others to respond to the mental health injuries are challenged by the existing workers' compensation systems in the United States. We're more than willing, for example, if workers' comp in the United States, when you get hurt at work, we're willing to compensate you for those mental stimulus that lead to a physical injury. So long as we can assess a physical injury, compensation generally will follow. If there's some physical trauma that may result in a mental injury, often workers' comp systems at least will tolerate and assess what the scope of the mental injury is. But when it's mental stimulus, stress and other related conditions from a post-traumatic stress syndrome type of condition that lead to mental injuries, workers' comp systems in several states simply do not recognize those claims. Not well at all. Literally leaving the person with the mental injury suffering as a result without any potential compensation even when they're engaged at work. It's highly problematic. And then you have these whole series of issues about actually how you provide the mental and behavioral services and treatment in the emergencies itself. The legal duties, the things that relate to when you have a duty to obtain informed consent, doesn't work well when you're engaged in mental health triage. How do you protect third parties from risks that may involve persons with mental health conditions? Often there's a whole sophisticated series of procedures you go through legally. We don't have time for that. We may have to impose issues and use different assessments of what constitutes due process to accomplish this. Entitlements to treatment of services. Frankly, individuals that are involuntarily confined or those that may be accessing certain governmental health programs, as we've documented in our scholarship, they may be front in line. They may have a very legitimate legal claim over whatever ethical standards are in place to get access to those mental health services beyond other patients that might be even more needy. Counselor-patient relationships, flat out, will not look like and cannot look like what you'd expect in a non-emergency situation. These must be capable of changing. Will the law recognize those changes sufficient to allow practitioners to step in and provide sufficient and important intervention? The access to psychotropic medications and other controlled substances I've mentioned, this is tightly controlled by the federal government through their regulations. There's been no appreciation during emergencies to lift those types of regulations sufficiently that others that might need access to these types of medications for their mental health conditions would actually get them. And then issues related to compulsory treatment. When we do have a non-adherent individual whose mental health condition poses risk to themselves or others, to compulsorily treat those individuals is highly contentious, as you know, in non-emergencies. Can it be done during an emergency event or in the direct aftermath of the emergency, consistent with constitutional due process? How is that actually paved out? These are the questions we're attempting to answer in this project. And then finally, let me just very briefly tell you about some of the legal and policy forms that we've recommended. First of all, we're really trying with this project to infuse mental and behavioral health priorities into all existing emergency laws and frameworks. It is as if many of these emergency laws were written without recognition of the mental health side of these events. That's got to change, and we're working to do that. We want to seek ways to provide interjurisdictional licensure coordination. We've talked with HHS about this at the federal level. They're interested in this. Question will be whether legally we can accomplish it in the federal system. Whether and how we would impose and use mental health impact assessments to guide what and how we respond to emergencies. We use health impact assessments in all sorts of other arenas, often looking at the physical side. How do we infuse a mental health capacity into that? How do we infuse mental health into a setting of a crisis standard of care, something even Don and I on the IOM committee recognized we did not do sufficiently? Protections from claim denials for post-traumatic stress syndrome and other diagnosed conditions. Workers' comp carriers, health and disability insurance disfavor these claims. They work hard to deny them in non-emergencies. You can imagine an emergency event, how hard that is. We've got to find ways to pave ways for these claims to be protected. And just special thanks to my colleagues back at Johns Hopkins and as well the student at Duke University who helped. Do we have time, Patricia, for any questions or comments? 4 minutes. I'm very excited about that. I'm sorry, as you can imagine, me having to rush through some of that, but I hope you got at least a very good sense of what we think. So, Patricia, shall I just call in, folks, and you tell me one more time? All right, I'll repeat the question, but let me hear it first.
Hi, I just wanted to comment on liability issues.
Yeah. Good.
The problem that we've had is that originally we put the team under the behavioral health wing of Medical Reserve Corps.
Mm-hmm.
They're only activated in large-scale disasters.
Right.
Liability only covers them for those declared events.
Yep.
So the only choice DBH really had was to use
Yeah, good.
But the primary issue is that for FEMA, for crisis counseling programs, you're not allowed to use existing mental health providers out of the system because you're essentially replacing people who are working on the system.
Right.
So what that means is that if we really had a very large-scale disaster, we wouldn't be able to use people who are trained and who do it on a regular basis and who are the most capable of that. So I'm just wondering if you know of any movement within FEMA to lighten that regulation in terms of reimbursement for people who come out of the provider system. I mean, that's really the biggest barrier right now for us responding to something large scale.
Gosh, it's a great question. I couldn't repeat all that if I wanted to, but what I will say is there a way through FEMA to recognize the potential for reimbursement of those folks so that you can train them and have them ready to go? You know what? I don't have an answer for you on that, but I promise you this. You discuss it with me a little bit after this session, we'll work to get it, and we'll try to get you a good response to that. I have a feeling there's a couple of avenues that we may be able to explore that may provide you the type of protection you're looking for, even if FEMA won't recognize that. But let's explore that a little bit together. It's a very good question, and I'm very pleased to hear about what City of Philadelphia is doing in that regard. So let's go to the other side, right here.
Yeah, well, I'm wondering if you are only working on policy issues at the national level, if you're also looking at state and local issues. So now here in Colorado, we're trying to do a lot of work with integrating behavioral health resources, given, I think, we're rated 47th in the nation, the lowest.
Wow.
In terms of emergency room responses and processing people impacted by disaster,
mm-hmm.
if there's any models being developed and implemented and actually tested in terms of the outcomes of that type of integration.
Great. Good stuff in Colorado for sure. And to repeat the question just briefly, are we working just on federal national approaches here? Or are we working down at the state and local level? Well, honestly, the answer to that is that's where the action's at, state and local level. And that's where we're working to actually accomplish significant potential reforms. Yeah, we're working with the feds on some of these issues to try to pave through some of the national concerns that may be easier to accomplish through some potential revisions in policy. But it is at the state and local level where we're particularly interested in seeing some of these reforms fall into place. And I'd be delighted to talk with you in Colorado about how we can work with any of the number of policymakers here to help you think these things through and accomplish those. Again, just let me know afterwards. I'll be happy to talk with you further about that. It's good stuff. Thank you. Yeah, back over here.
I noticed you have quite a few pictures of the Haiti earthquake disaster.
Mm-hmm.
The disaster response team down there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so it's very difficult. You're right, because I've used Haiti as a good example just because of the enormity of the consequences on the population there. It's the most significant illustration of the potential long-term mental health impacts. You know, working with the federal government on some of the response efforts there, and I'll be very brief with my response here, there really were significant legal issues that were and did thwart certain response efforts initially that we worked through federally to accomplish very specific ways to basically circumvent those issues, and that actually worked quite well. For example, we recognized through federal law certain licensure reciprocity provisions so that practitioners could go down to Haiti, provide certain services, including from the mental health perspective, not worry about the licensure issues and not worry about liability issues. That was done federally at that level. But those same issues really are dominant at the state level here when we have national or domestic concerns. And as a result, this project, even though I've used Haiti as a nice backdrop, we're very much focused on how we improve upon these specific service delivery efforts in the United States because of the profound issues that we still have to work through on those fronts. Now, I'll be very brief now and thank you all and look forward to additional questions perhaps at the end. Thank you.